You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Cyclocross Podcast, as we've been rebranded, maybe permanently, thanks to the response to last week's episode.
This week.
In which we discussed the World Championships.
This week I'm going to like everything. I'm just going to be relentlessly positive about everything.
This week on Daniel Freiba on how mud is the new tarmac, and forget about the Stelvio, it's all about Coxsider now.
Preferably indoors, preferably on a velo bowl.
That's Daniel Freiba. I'm Richard Moore, and there's Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
Did you? You've not been cancelled for your views on cyclocross.
I think I might have been.
Certainly, by some people.
A new range of t-shirts coming with a quote: "Cyclocross is demeaning." I think we'll put on
degrading.
Degrading as a slogan.
Even better. No, there were some great lines last week. Designed to provoke, of course, Daniel. Mainly Lionel. Designed to provoke Lionel. But all good fun. All good fun. We are moving on from cyclocross, I think, aren't we? Reluctantly.
Mercifully.
We'll return to cyclocross next year for some more expert analysis. we're well into the road season. We're doing something a bit different this week. We're going to hear from a Grand Tour winner. We've got an interview with a Grand Tour winner in this week's episode.
Pavel Tonkov, 52 today.
52 today. I was going to say,
is it Big Pav?
We're going to play out with Daniel singing "Happy Birthday" to Pavel Tonkov, as is traditional. We're going to hear from a Grand Tour winner. We're going to dig into the Team Ineos this year and what we might expect from them. Rumors or claims of a new direction for Team Ineos Grenadiers. The Grand Tour winner is an Ineos Grenadiers rider, so we'll hear from him a bit later on. All very mysterious at this point. Lionel, do you have a news roundup for us, please?
I do indeed, Rich. Yeah, well, Ineos Grenadiers were one of the teams that caught the eye at the Étoile de Bessèges stage race. I mean, Tim Wellens won it overall for Lotto Soudal. I mean, it was a race pretty much designed for a rider like Tim Wellens to win. Very Tim Wellens-friendly parcours down there in southern France. The stages were won by Christophe Laporte of Cofidis and Timothy Dupont of Bingol Wallonie before Wellens won the third stage. And then it was a Filippo Ganna fest over the last couple of days, wasn't it? He won stage 4 after being in a long break, a really impressive stage victory for the Ineos Grenadiers rider. And then, perhaps more predictably, he won the final 10-kilometre time trial, which had a really nasty sting in the tail towards the end. Ganna was out of the overall picture because he lost time on the day that Wellens won. So overall, it was Tim Wellens ahead of Mikhail Kwiatkowski, who is Ineos Grenadiers' best place rider overall, with Niels Pollitt in third place and the young British rider Jake Stewart of Groupama FDJ in fourth place. And one little snippet from the Étoile de Bessèges, which, as we said last week, had a much stronger field than it has had for many a year because of the various race cancellations. Ineos Grenadiers were offered an invite to the race on the condition that they would also send a team to next year's race. So quite canny on the part of the organisers there. The big kind of news that's made quite a splash on social media is some UCI rule changes. The most eye-catching aspect of this is banning the so-called super tuck descending position. That's when riders get out of the saddle and sit on the top tube when going downhill. That position will now be prohibited.
Lionel, will the position that both Ganna and Wellens used to win their stages, resting the forearms on the bars?
Well, that technically already is not accounted for in the rules. It could be penalised in the rules because the rules say that when a rider is on the bike, that the position requires that the only points of support are feet on the pedals, hands on the handlebars, and seat on the saddle. So the idea of resting forearms on the bars, it's going to just be more rigorously enforced, that particular UCI rule. This is the thing that has really created the debate, and I'll ask you guys what you think about it in a minute. But probably the most significant rule changes for rider safety are a whole raft of measures to improve the barriering at the end of stages, and also considerations when it comes to designing courses, particularly for stages that are that are going to finish in a sprint. And there are also some significantly increased penalties for riders littering, whether that's with empty water bottles or with gel wrappers. Race organisers are going to be required to have more litter zones spaced out every 30 or 40 kilometres, and there will be some pretty tough penalties for breaking the rules, that is throwing away litter outside of those zones. First infringement in a stage race would be a 30 second penalty, second infringement a 2 minute penalty, and a third infringement could be disqualification. And those rules come into force on April the 1st and have caused a bit of a stir, haven't they?
Well, chaps, that creates the possibility of a grand tour being lost because of littering. That would be quite extraordinary, wouldn't it?
The cleanest rider will win. It's what cycling's cycling's been striving for years. A raft of new measures and safety managers for events as well. I mean, a lot of it is to be applauded, but the super tuck ban has been the one that's certainly exercised the riders, and it's there's a real sort of divide opening up between a lot of the riders and the CPA who were representing them, perhaps not very effectively. With the UCI, and it's been interesting getting riders, reactions on social media, because what's clear is that they are as divided as everybody else on this. There doesn't seem to be a real consensus. Can I read out a couple of tweets from riders which I thought were quite interesting? Max Schachman, the Boer Hansgrohe rider: I welcome the UCI's efforts to make cycling safer, but I'm not sure if the super tuck ban is the right way. I think we could see new aero riding positions being established that circumvent this new rule. The question is then if these new positions are safer or even more dangerous. And then Jacopo Guarnieri, who kept an audio diary for us at the Giro last year: I think those UCI rules about arms on the handlebar and descending positions are good, although I'm still waiting to know what was or will be the sanctions for the Tour of Poland organiser, which is a very good point. Referring, of course, to the crash last year involving Fabi Jakobsen and Dylan Groenewegen. So the riders themselves, I mean, quite a few of them, people like Michal Kwiatkowski, who does use that position quite a lot, very opposed to the ban. But I think that ever since I first saw it, Matej Mohoric in the World Championships in Florence in 2013, it's one thing for professional riders to do it. I think the danger is in others copying it. And you only have to look at it to see that the balance of the bike looks all wrong. Although, as Schachman says, we've seen other descending positions in the past, both hands behind the bottom, for example, or hanging over the back wheel, which are equally, if not more, dangerous.
Well, I think the example that the pro set is important, isn't it, Rich? In terms of young riders or aspiring riders watching, and weekend riders watching, and people who don't necessarily have the bike handling skills that the pros have. But also, I think it's to be welcomed and to be applauded that the UCI have done something before. We have seen an accident caused by whether it be the super tuck position or hands dangling over the handlebars. Usually these measures are introduced in response to something tragic or unfortunate happening. So I think that's a good thing. And also, thirdly, I would just say is that there are rules about the way equipment is used and held and manoeuvred in most sports. And bike handlebars are designed to be held.
Yeah, and I think the rule applies to everyone. That's the thing. I mean, it's not... Yeah, some riders might well have been more willing to get into the super tuck position or dangle their hands over the handlebars more than others, but the rule will be applied to everyone equally. I think the question will be about enforcement, in race enforcement. How will that happen? Will riders be, in the super tuck position, and then when they're riding on the Valley Road, be told that they're disqualified? We'll wait and see how this is actually applied to real world circumstances. But Rich, you mentioned Mohoric, and our friend Tony Gruden from Slovenian TV, he credits Mohoric with evolving the modern super tuck position, figuring it out during training in Slovenia when he was descending in the mountains in 2011. I think, did you say the first time you saw it used in a race?
2013, I think, in Florence, yeah.
Well, there we are. And Daniel, you made a sort of throwaway comment, ho-ho, about littering, possibly a Grand Tour being decided because a rider is penalised for littering. I mean, I can't see any argument against these penalties. I think they're a good idea. It's a tough penalty, but once again, it's all about the enforcement, isn't it? It's going to be what the commissaires see rather than the offences committed is going to be where the controversy is going to come in. I mean, somebody spotted on television throwing a bottle away or throwing a wrapper away outside of one of the littering zones, if that's captured on camera, they're more likely to be penalised than if it's somebody doing it away from the gaze of the TV cameras. But certainly in stage races, the penalties are really stiff enough to create an immediate culture change. And I think that is a good thing. Having made a Kilometre Zero episode about the sport's impact on the environment, but also the environment's impact on the sport during the tour last year, the one thing that everybody was kind of united on really was that there's just no need to throw stuff away when you've got pockets in your jersey. And I can't really see any argument against that. I mentioned the stage race penalties. For one-day races, there are various fines penalising UCI ranking points and also a provision to eliminate or disqualify a rider from a race. So, like I say, tough penalties for littering. Shall I carry on with the rest of the news? Peter Sagan, Juraj Sagan, his brother, and Erik Baska, all of Bora Hansgrohe, have tested positive for COVID-19 at the end of their training camp in Gran Canaria and are now quarantining. And it does mean that Peter Sagan may not make his season debut at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad at the end of the month. We'll wait and see what happens there. The Australian Road Race Championships went ahead. The men's race was won for the second year in a row by Cameron Meyer, and the women's race was won by Sarah Roy. So it was a double for Team Bike Exchange. Richard, you watched those races, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the men's road race was a humdinger. It was a great sort of tactical race. I have to sort of credit the Australian presentation as well. I mean, they had fans in the course. It was all very tightly managed and controlled. And the way that the race was broadcast too, I mean, we know Matt Keenan and Robbie McEwen very well, Bridie O'Donnell joined them, and David McKenzie was roadside, but McKenzie was sort of positioned on a hill and they would throw to him every time the riders were passing him, and it was really good. Obviously it's a lapse of a circuit. I don't know if they've done this before because I haven't watched it before, but it was great to have him reporting on the action with the action happening behind him. That was great, and that commentary team is excellent, and the race itself was a brilliant, brilliant race. Mitch Docker interviewed Cam Meyer last year, and we called that episode the Master Tactician, and this was, Bike Exchange, formerly Mitchelton Scott, were really on the rack. They used up all their good riders chasing the young rider, Luke Plapp, very, very promising young Australian rider who beat Luke Durbridge in the time trial. And it really ended up almost Durbridge kind of chasing him down. And then it was a bit of a free-for-all. And then somehow at the end, Cameron Meyer emerged to defend his title. But if you have the GCN race pass, you can go back and watch the race if you haven't already. And it is an absolute cracker.
Meanwhile, the hearing into the former Team Sky and British Cycling doctor Richard Freeman is still ongoing. Richard Freeman's QC, Mary O'Rourke, has been making her final submissions to the hearing, and she has dismissed the GMC's case, basically saying that there is no proof that Dr. Freeman ordered testo gel for the purposes of doping a rider. She maintains that Dr. Freeman's explanation that the testo gel was for Shane Sutton is the truth. Sutton denies that. The hearing continues, I believe, on Friday, and we are getting to the point where there will be some kind of finding after a case that has been dragging on. It's into its third year now, isn't it? Steve Cummings, the former Team Sky rider, rode for Team Sky for a couple of years, 2010 and 2011, being retired a little while now, and he is joining Ineos Grenadiers as a development director, sportif, and coach. And, this just sparked something that Dave Brailsford told me one morning at the Tour de France when I had a socially distanced conversation with him outside the Ineos bus. He dropped a hint that they were looking at starting a development team, so perhaps this is the first step on the road to that. And finally, the Tour de la Provence is this weekend's big race, a four-day stage race in the south of France. Starts on Thursday. Saturday stage is the one to watch because it goes to Chalet Reynard, which of course is towards the top of Mont Ventoux. Anything else in the news, Daniel?
Well, Lionel, you mentioned a fabulous performance by Filippo Ganna at the Étoile de Bessèges. Another very notable performance by an Ineos rider at the weekend. Tom Pidcock claimed to have run a 13-minute, 25-second 5 kilometres, or he certainly posted on social media that he had run a 5 kilometres. That's about 50 seconds off the men's world record for 5 kilometres, and right up there, I would say, with Kim Jong-il's 34 under par 18 holes at Pyongyang golf course in 1994. Not sure, I believe.
Well, it's been slightly discredited already.
Are you sure he wasn't just cycling through some mud and he had his Strava on run rather than cycling?
We're not talking about cycling through mud this week, Lionel.
Chaps, only a few weeks. How long is it now? About 5 weeks till Milan-San Remo. We haven't heard too much about the course. Last year, of course, it was a different course to the usual traditional one because of the revised dates, and it was difficult to take the race on the Riviera. So it went inland, and there's been talk about that course being used again in 2021, not least because Mauro Vegni, the race director, fell out with some of the local mayors on the old route. We still don't know whether it's going to revert to the old route. So over the Turchino, well, I'll get to that in a minute, but down the coast over the Capi, and then the Cipressa and the Poggio. The one change we do already know about, and we can say for sure, is that the race is not going to go over the Turchino, which is the biggest climb on the Milan-San Remo route traditionally every year, and there's been a landslide on the Turchino. This has happened before. In 2001, 2002, the race had to circumvent the Turchino, and it went over a climb called Bric Berton, and it didn't really affect the race too much, but various options are being looked at by RCS. I think one is to do that climb again, the Bric Berton. Another one is to do the same route as last year, so go inland and take a slightly longer route to San Remo. Another thing, chaps, that caught my eye and will have caught the eye of the many Pinophiles out there, Thibaut Pinophiles, very long interview with him in L'Equipe this morning. Quintessentially Thibaut Pinot, this interview, 4 pages long. And you'll probably remember Pinot. Well, he had a terrible time at the Tour de France last year. He's had a litany of misfortunes over the last couple of years, starting with his abandonment of the 2019 Tour. Last year at the Tour, he crashed on the first day, had back problems throughout the rest of the race, did finish it, and then went to the Vuelta, quit after a couple of days, and has been pretty down on his luck since then. Has talked a lot about having lost his love of cycling, and this was a pretty wide-ranging interview in which he talked about these misfortunes, but also other things like, for example, corticoids and therapeutic use exemptions, and the fact that, well, he's never been prepared to use corticoids, and he feels now that had he used them with a therapeutic use exemption, for example, at the 2019 Tour or even at the Tour last year, then he might have fared better. But he's obviously got pretty strong views about corticoids and riders using them with a therapeutic use exemption or not. One quote from the interview: a guy with a TUE has no business being on a bike. I can't understand guys racing on cortisone. And he also talked a lot about the lack of testing at the moment. This is a subject that we've touched on over the last few months. Obviously, it's very difficult for the national anti-doping agencies and WADA and other testing agencies to get around, to travel at the moment. Pino said that the last time he was tested was last August, or last time out of competition. He said, I was playing Patonk with my neighbours at about 8 o'clock one evening. I think it was before the tour. And since then, I've not had a single out of competition test. Everyone's worried about it. I mean, they do target test. So I hope some riders are being tested more than me. But yeah, very sort of quintessentially Pino-esque kind of, well, vision that, isn't it, of him, you know, being interrupted while playing Patonk to give a blood or urine sample. But as I said, Pino fans will absolutely lap up this interview. The thing that really strikes me about it, and has always struck me about him, is that it's very authentic and it's very honest. And the great thing about Thibaut Pino, at a time, in an age when people are sort of encouraged to, even when they're talking about how they're struggling in life, they're always encouraged to embroider it with a sort of a positive payoff line or a silver lining at the end. Pino kind of makes no apology for the fact that sometimes life is just a bit shit, really. and he sort of owns that. And I think people, that sort of resonates with a lot of people, as I say, at a time when, particularly on social media.
He said he would have sold himself if he ran the team. He wouldn't want to manage himself.
Given himself away or sold himself. But yeah, there is something that sort of will resonate with a lot of fans, as I say, about that kind of authenticity that, you know, often riders will sort of express these sentiments about how they're struggling, and it will always be footnoted with talk of how they're hoping to, you know, get back on track, or, you know, how they're hoping to turn their career around. But he is someone who tends to kind of, well, some people would call it wallowing, but others would say that he doesn't really sugarcoat the difficulties that he's going through at any particular time. And that makes him quite different and quite engaging.
And yet he falls for the cliched 30-something line of saying how much more fun and carefree everything was in professional cycling 10 years ago when he first got into it. I mean,
and he said they went to see the clown in the Start Village. I don't remember a clown in the Start Village 10 years ago, do you?
No, one of our listeners, I think, Moyen, one of our loyal listeners, said that was a very unkind way to refer to Marc Madiot.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWalker. We are very grateful indeed to their support. And if you run a small business, you'd like to know more about what iWalker can do for you, go to iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Now, we're going to hear from Ineos Grenadiers rider soon, Teo Gegenhart, the winner of the Giro d'Italia, of course. And we're going to talk a bit about Ineos Grenadiers. They got underway at Étoile de Bessèges, had a good race there. But they've also, quite unusually for them, announced their lineups for the Grand Tours, certainly the Giro and the Tour de France. Not their complete lineups, but they've said, you know, who's going where. Compare that to last year. Obviously, a very unusual year last year, but there was huge uncertainty, wasn't there, about who would go to the Tour de France. And they were using these warm-up races to establish whether Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas were going to be in the sort of form where they could do a job at the Tour, and they weren't. So they were not selected for the Tour. And Richard Carapaz was switched quite late from the Giro to the Tour to support Egan Bernal. This year, they've taken a slightly different tack with quite an early announcement that Bernal will go to the Giro to rediscover the joy of racing, said Dave Brailsford. And he'll be supported there by Pavel Sivakov. And at the Tour, there'll be a kind of three-pronged attack, it seems, with Geraint Thomas, the winner in 2018, of course, supported by Richard Carapaz and Teo Gegenhardt, making his debut at the race. And Carapaz made his debut last year. And Lionel, you and I and Francois Thomazeau were driving to La Planche des Belles Filles on the penultimate day of the Tour last year when we came across Dave Brailsford riding his bike. And he was waxing lyrical about Carapaz. He'd obviously been very attacking in that final week and said that he'd really figured out the Tour and wanted to come back to try and win it. So of those three, maybe Carapaz looks the most likely potential leader, but they're on a fairly even footing, I would have thought. All got quite different skill sets and strengths. What are your thoughts, Daniel?
Well, I think the most striking thing about this announcement is that we don't even know the Vuelta route and we don't even know the Giro route yet. There are some riders and teams who have taken one look at the Tour route and the time trials, the two time trials there, only three mountaintop finishes, a lot of mountain stages that finish on descents or at the end of descents, and have decided straight away that they're not going there or they're not sending their climbers there. I think the Ineos provisional selections make a lot of sense on numerous levels. One in particular is that I think it's a good idea to send Teo Gegenhardt to the Tour de France. I think there would have been quite a lot of pressure on him to repeat his exploits of the Giro last year, defend his title. And sending him to the Tour will alleviate some of that. He's never ridden the Tour before. And, you know, we tend to cut debutants at the Tour a lot of slack. It's such a different race and different experience to be there that I don't think anyone expects him to win the Tour de France, which is not to say it won't.
I mean, when's the last time a debutant won the Tour de France?
Well, there you go, about 6 months ago. So I think that makes sense. The interesting question to me, the most interesting question, is how they're going to ride and to what extent they're going to follow up on this sort of battle cry by Dave Brailsford to ride differently, more aggressively, ride like Brazil with so many leaders, half leaders, sort of semi leaders. Richie Porte was on the podium at the Tour de France last year and no one's even mentioning him as one of the leaders of the Tour team, although he is penciled in to ride the Tour. Laurens de Ploeg is a new signing to the team. He doesn't intend to just be a domestique, I don't think, at Ineos, but he's certainly almost been cast in that role already in the Tour team. And there's Kwiatkowski, Castroviejo. And the other question I'm sort of sitting here asking myself or wondering about is how this will butt up, measure up against whatever Jumbo-Visma tried to do. Interestingly enough, in the interview that Primoz Roglic gave to L'Equipe last week that we mentioned, he also talked about riding slightly differently in 2021 and having or wanting to have a bit more fun. He felt that the team Jumbo-Visma rode a bit too conservatively last year. So how are the two forces that we expect to really dominate the Tour in 2021, leaving Pogacar to one side at the moment, how are they going to sort of rub up against each other?
So it sounds like everyone's going to be having fun apart from Thibaut Pinot, who's going to be searching in the village for the clown that was never there.
I think the comment from Dave Brailsford that really did make my ears stand to attention. Do ears stand to attention? No.
Maybe yours do. I don't know.
Was this, this cross sport reference to, you know, preparing like Germany and playing like Brazil, presumably a football reference. I mean, Brazil haven't reached the World Cup final since 2002. That's nearly 20 years ago. I do get what he's saying, but I think it's, you know, it's easy to sort of look back on the Giro as this sort of beguiling, free-form, free-spirited Grand Tour that just, you know, they had a plan and then the plan had to be changed and then, like sort of, you know, a, a, a solo at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. They just tippy-tapped their way into contention and finished with the ultimate flourish. I mean, it was fantastic to watch. But I think that very rarely in any team sport does the boss, the head coach, the mastermind sort of lay out in front of everybody what the tactical plan is going to be ahead of time. I mean, generally you see the change happen. And I know, Daniel, you've talked about how few, relatively few kind of tactical innovations there have been in cycling. And I wouldn't have said that last year's Giro was a tactical innovation. It was an excellent adaptation to changed circumstances. Racing, as the race unfolded, as Geraint Thomas was obviously ruled out, day by day, just doing the best that could be done until they were in a position. I just don't see the sort of the template of the Tour de France being ripped up, and this sort of romantic idea of Ineos Grenadiers creating total cycling with sending riders off in breaks. I think it will be difficult to break from the norm, because Jumbo-Visma will ride the way they want to ride, and if Ineos Grenadiers got into the yellow jersey at the Tour de France, that they're going to settle into the familiar pattern of defending the race lead and making sure they get the race won, not kind of airy-fairy notions of free-form cycling, are they?
The looming danger is that you become what people would disparagingly refer to as a bad Movistar, a bad version of Movistar. We've seen them come into Grand Tours with multiple leaders before. But then you look at the role played by, for example, Marc Soler in the Vuelta last year. And he's a guy who causes a lot of damage, can outride a peloton in certain circumstances.
Not least for his own
team. Well, yeah, he can outride a peloton in certain circumstances. And you kind of transpose that to Ineos and imagine them trying something similar with their third leader, and the problem is you have to have those riders sitting pretty on general classification for it to really take any chunk out of, in this case, Jumbo-Visma. Soler at the Vuelta last year, he was in some fantastic moves, but Jumbo-Visma just sort of sat in the peloton looking at each other, shrugging their shoulders, sort of asking themselves what on earth was he thinking that he was achieving.
Well, I think it wasn't just the Giro last year. I think it was the Tour de France as well, where Carapaz was sort of effervescent and very exciting rider, really lit up that final part of the Tour. If you look at the Tour and the Giro, the thing they had in common was misfortune struck their leaders in both races, Bernal at the Tour and then Geraint Thomas at the Giro, and that freed them up. But they also, I think, lent heavily on those two riders, Carapaz at the Tour and Filippo Ganna at the Giro, who, in the way that they rode, it sort of inspired the rest of the team. And Brailsford spoke about that. And I could see why he found those races personally very enjoyable. I mean, he mentioned that stage that was won by Kwiatkowski ahead of Carapaz when the two of them got away. He said that they'd got more sort of publicity around that and more goodwill generated by that than by winning the Tour. I think the thing that will dictate to a large extent how they ride is always the personnel. We'll hear Teo Gegenhardt talk about this as well. But, it was interesting a couple of weeks ago talking about Jumbo-Visma and wanting to go to the Tour with three leaders, Dumoulin, who's obviously now stopped for the time being, Kruijswijk and Roglic, just for the different options that would give them. It's a very different scenario for Jumbo-Visma, for Ineos now as well, to be going to the Tour without a really clear favourite. When you had Chris Froome winning year after year and being the outstanding favourite, there was a very clear way to ride, wasn't there? There was really only one way to ride. Whereas they'll go to the Tour this year without the clear favourite. And so it does force upon you the necessity to adapt the way that you race a little bit. I agree, of course, that if they find themselves in the yellow jersey, they will revert to that defensive way of riding. Any team would. But if they don't, you know, then they will be forced, I think, to try different things.
Yeah, I mean, they responded to adversity in the Tour the only way they could, which was to go hunting for stage wins. But riding in that way, the way that Carapaz did in the final week, was in the hunt for the King of the Mountains jersey. But he was 25 minutes down. I mean, he was out of the picture. And it's easy to ride with that. We see it every year, don't we? The team that has had its GC hopes dashed, or the rider who's suffered a bad opening week or 10 days... gets a lot more leeway in the final week of the race than the riders who are doing that kind of defensive grind round in fifth, sixth, seventh place. What I'm saying is, I just don't see that the style that Brailsford's alluding to being compatible with trying to win the Tour de France. I'm not trying to say that you can only win the Tour de France in a boring manner, because Tadej Pogacar didn't win the Tour de France in a boring manner. I mean, that was a pretty swashbuckling win. But I just think that when you've got all of the expectation, and the expectation will be that Ineos Grenadiers get back to winning ways and win the Tour de France with one of their multiple leaders. Because if they go into the Tour with a three-pronged approach, three potential winners or riders who could very easily be on the podium, you've got to bear in mind there will be another two or three, four maybe, who aren't even in the Tour. You know, that's what I'm saying, that the expectation is so high with Ineos Grenadiers that I'm not sure that this idea of, you know, the footloose, fancy-free cycling is necessarily going to be the reality when we get into the thick of the races.
Well, particularly just on the Tour de France, Lionel, with the time trial in the Tour de France coming after 1 week, the likelihood is that... one team, if it is Ineos in this case, you know, if they happen to take the yellow jersey there, then as you guys say, they'll quickly fall into that groove that they know very well of just controlling, or trying at least to control the race.
Just one thing I would say about the whole season for Ineos Grenadiers, and looking back at the team since it started as Team Sky in 2010, there are still some real noticeable blanks in the team palmarès. They've never won a Tour of Flanders, never won a Paris-Roubaix, never won a Île Lombardia, only won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, won by Wout Poels a few years ago. There's an opportunity in classic races to really try something different, and maybe you know, that's where we'll see a bit of swashbuckling riding from I don't know, maybe, I mean, Michał Kwiatkowski is probably their best hope in one day races, but I mean, the stage races, I just think they'll revert to type, just because that's how you get the job done.
We did a French special a couple of years ago, didn't we, on their failure in the classics, because it's striking. You know, they've gone many classics campaigns without even finishing in the top 10 in these races, and you know, clearly somebody like Luke Rowe and Dylan van Baarle, they can do very well in these races, but they're all enthralled to the Tour. I think as a team, it's such a big focus that it detracts a little even from their preparation for those races. But this is where they don't measure up that well against Jumbo-Visma, who've got, you know, in Wout van Aert, somebody who can really win these races and yet also do really well at the Tour. And they've never really had a rider like that.
Well, chaps, I know they've already won Milan-San Remo with Michał Kwiatkowski, but of course Filippo Ganna's going to win this year.
Is he going to win this year?
I think it's the absolute perfect race for him. He was second. He was the second rider over the Cipressa last year. And I just looked at, there were a few things online sort of dissecting the power numbers that he did at the weekend at the Étoile de Bessèges. And the sort of attack that he put in there, it just struck me that it would be, I mean, it's very different circumstances, different profile, different length of race. But if he goes much in the same way that Fabian Cancellara did in Milan-San Remo when he won it, if he goes and someone is not on his wheel in the, you know, in the first split seconds, then he could be home and dry.
It's funny. I mean, we should, you know, that stage when, or the road stage when at Bessèges was extraordinary. He'd been in the breakaway all day. Some pretty strong riders, including Alberto Bettiol, came up to the group, and then he just rode away from them. It was like he'd been playing with them all day, and when he went, you know, it was just
a bazooka in a knife fight, wasn't it?
It was a bazooka and a knife fight. I did see some claimed power numbers for him. 12 minutes 27 seconds average, 488 watts, maximum 988. The first 6 minutes of his attack, average 509 watts, maximum 988. Pretty amazing. And the guys behind, just, you know, including Betty Olive, Tour Flanders winner, this just couldn't make any impression at all.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Voilà, j'ai défait notre valise et je l'ai mis sous le lit.
Well, it's very reassuring to know, Richard, that the suitcase is under the bed, but what's going on there?
Well, you've caught me in the middle of my babble lesson, Lionel, of course. I just manage them whenever I can. You know, if I've got a spare few minutes, I'll just jump onto a babble lesson and brush up on my French.
Well, we can't all be as gifted linguistically as Daniel, can we, unfortunately? But babble, no, helping you to move ever closer towards fluency in your adopted home, no?
Yeah, that's like saying that your latest Zwift session is edging you ever closer to winning the Tour de France.
But every little helps, Richard, I think. That's the thing with learning languages, isn't it? It's about little and often, I think, with something like Babbel, and that's what it's built to do, isn't it? The building blocks of language, as they say, and as you point out, you can just slot a lesson in between recording podcast sections.
Well, joking apart, I was getting some help from a cycling coach with my cycling, just to improve my fitness, and he kept saying consistency is key, and it's exactly the same with learning a language. And in the run-up to Christmas especially, I was using Babbel religiously every day, and it really did make a difference. And it was commented upon by those around me that I did suddenly make a little breakthrough. And if you can just do a little bit every day, it really does make a big difference. And I do enjoy Babbel. They have sponsored several episodes of the cycling podcast now, and I've been using it in between. You can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. The teaching method has been proven to be effective across multiple studies, and it's available as an app or online, and your progress is synced across all your devices. The lessons are created by over 100 language experts, meaning real people, and not by a translation machine. So you won't start speaking like a Google translation, which is reassuring.
Voilà, j'ai défait notre valise et je l'ai mis sous le lit.
Indeed. Well, right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a 6 month subscription with the promo code CYCLE. Go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code CYCLE on your 6 month subscription. That's babbel.co.uk/play, promo code CYCLE. Well, on the subject of Ineos Grenadiers, I spoke to Theo Gegenhardt this week. It's been confirmed now that he will ride his first Tour de France. So I spoke to him about that and other things besides. Well, listen, you're on the eve of the new season. I mean, how are you feeling? How's the winter gone, and how are you feeling about racing restarting?
Yeah, I mean, obviously a bit of a strange thought, you saying that, as it were, really, because should have finished up first race yesterday. I guess, you know, continuation of last year and rolling with, I don't want to say rolling with the punches, actually, that's not true, but, you know, being adaptable to the situation, I think. So, I've had to move plans around and cancel one camp I had in mind before Paris-Nice, but, you know, that's the way of the world. And I think it was the right decision, looking at the numbers and stuff they had down in Valencia case-wise, from my uneducated position. And equally, I'm excited to get racing in about 10 days' time. So I feel really good. It's been a short winter, but it's been a productive one. I'm excited to get back racing, really, which is obviously a cliched expression, but
you were in Gran Canaria for a bit, and you've been in Andorra. Are you able to train okay there? Is there a lot of snow?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be a little bit adaptable here, but I think for every kind of not great day, there's normally three or four fantastic ones. So, yeah, I mean, you've obviously got the massive advantage of being in the mountains, living at altitude, and I know it gave me a lot last year and equally in the years before in my career, and yeah, no need to change that now. I was kind of planning to go back to Tenerife, which I did last year, literally just before the pandemic started, to kind of do a slightly different block before Paris-Nice with more focus on heat, and obviously it's just a great place to train there. But yeah, that's been canned now. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. I think I'm a big planner, like we've probably kind of discussed previously, and part of that is also just, you know, scrapping best laid plans and getting stuck into new ones, I guess.
Well, one plan that we do know of is for you to ride the Tour de France this year. Was that a big decision? Was that something you had to think about, especially with regard to the Giro and whether you went back to defend your Giro title, or was it a decision that the team made? Was it, you know, how much of a say did you have in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the team's great. They always want to know for you know, for all whatever we are, 30 or so riders, they want to know what excites each rider and what motivations they have. And it always starts with that. And then the team, you know, tries their best to work with that and equally to take that into consideration. And I've always been aware of that since I was an Aeropro, really. And, you know, first joined the team, that they're very open to hearing what each rider not only kind of aspired to longer term, but also was kind of motivated by in the short term. Yeah, it was a conversation. I think ultimately the team was pretty clear that I could also kind of have a big say, which is, you know, somewhat of a new experience for me, to be honest. But yeah, it is a difficult process to go through. I think there's massive pluses and benefits and whatever to either kind of option that I felt I had, and both excited me. But this maybe gives me a little bit of a different rhythm than I've had for the last few years, which is a nice thought, in terms of kind of trying to hit the ground really running in the spring and then having a bit of a break, kind of, yeah, after that first block, and then building back up for July. So yeah, I'm excited first and foremost to get back racing and take each step as it comes. I think it's easy to get carried away looking, you know, a few months down the line, but also important to look to the next days and weeks, to be honest, now more than ever.
Is the tour a bit of a scratch that you want to itch as well as a professional cyclist? Every professional cyclist wants to ride the Tour de France. So is that something that you feel that at this stage in your career you just need to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, I guess so. Not massively. I think it's more kind of a bit more of like a thought process of thinking, do you know, is this a race that you see yourself wanting to perform in the future? And if so, then of course you need to first and foremost get the experience of being there yourself. And I mean, to some extent, I think, you know, bike racing is pretty similar, and certainly the Grand Tours are pretty similar. But then, you know, conversely, I think the Tour is a completely unique prospect within cycling and within the world of sport as well. Hence its kind of notoriety, I guess. So yeah, I think it's important now, 25 years old, 26 in a few months, to get there. But equally, it's not just about getting there, to be honest. That's one tiny piece of the puzzle. You know, getting there in the best shape possible and navigating the tricky parts of it. You know, first and foremost, the first week and all the rest of it, and then kind of getting into more of the racing that I would say suits me is a whole other kettle of fish. So yeah, like any good thing, I think one step at a time. And And to be honest, looking forward to Haltvar next week, hopefully Paris-Nice and Catalunya pretty swiftly after that, and let the bigger picture take care of itself, maybe to some extent, with that in mind, if that makes sense.
Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you who's going to lead the team at the Tour, but you were part of this very dynamic team performance at the Giro, which you know apparently inspired Dave Brailsford to really, you know, look at how the team races and to try and implement a new way of racing this year. Was that just talk, or are we going to really see a new style of racing from Ineos this year, do you think? And will we see that at the Tour?
I mean, let's see. I think it's up to the riders first and foremost to follow through on that. And I guess, you know, to a lesser extent, the director group who, you know, set our plans and performance plans pre-race and day-to-day tactics. Yeah, certainly I don't have any doubt about how we're gonna race. I think cycling is always very dynamic. And yeah, perhaps in the past people have pigeonholed the team in one way or another, but I think there's a very clear motivation as a group of how we want to approach this year. But yeah, let's see. I think, you know, the guys raced Bessège up to yesterday. They won two stages. Creto was second on GC. They had a great week by the sounds of it. So, of course, it's a bit of a different ball game when you get to, you know, Paris-Nice or some of the big World Tour races. But at the same time, I think that, you know, we've always been a team who've created our own path, I think, to some extent. And certainly as a rider group, I think that we're really motivated to focus on ourselves and to approach the races how we want to. So, yeah, in that sense, I don't see why we can't follow through on getting stuck in, if not to put it simply.
What do you think about the super tuck position?
You dropped that on me there. I haven't put too much thought into it, to be honest. I think if it's enforced and they, you know, as the governing body of the sport, want to make that rule, then so be it.
I can't recall you using it. Are you a fan of it?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, 100%. But I think I understand the argument, which, you know, a friend kind of said to me yesterday, actually, a fellow pro, that, you know, we lead by example for young riders, and you know, yes, there hasn't really been a high profile bad crash in the pros from that, but you know, maybe there has been with young riders. It's, you know, as he rightly said, it's not something that would perhaps make the international news, but I can understand that side of it. I think, you know, in the same way that we race with helmets, you know, to encourage, if not to protect ourselves, also to encourage young riders to protect themselves. I think the question I have is enough being done for rider safety? And is, you know, is this priority number one? I don't know the answer to that. But I think I wouldn't want this to be the narrative. And I mean, I guess it is, because you've asked me about it. But when we see some of the other things that are happening, perhaps it would be better if that was what everyone was talking about, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, just finally then, you sort of mentioned there, I suppose, the role that you have as role models. I mean, you seem to have used your profile over the winter more to make your voice heard in terms of supporting cycling a bit more widely than just the narrow world that you're in of professional cycling. Is that something that you put, that was a sort of conscious thing that you thought about, how you could maybe use your elevated profile to do something, to make some positive change? Is that the thing that that you decided on to kind of get behind? Is it, and is that, you know, what are your ambitions with that?
First and foremost, I don't think I've done anything, to be honest. I don't think giving a few interviews and whatnot is action whatsoever. I think it's perhaps not the opposite, but it's nothing really. Obviously, it's been a tricky climate. I had some plans, for example, to do some stuff with some schools in Hackney and all the rest of it in November, and it just became impossible with COVID and such, which was a shame. But I think, you know, that's not something that necessarily has to. I certainly believe that can still happen in the future, put it that way. I think, yeah, there's a lot to be done. I think for me, the main focus is more about, I don't want to keep saying it, it's cycling with a small C, not the sport. I think that the sport, is aided by more people riding bikes and using them for transport, and especially more kids just having a bike even. And yeah, kind of that's definitely what interests me. I wouldn't say it was massively conscious thing. It's not something new this winter. It's just that, you know, perhaps there's been more of a platform to speak about those things. And yeah, we were in, like you said, we were in Gran Canaria. I joined super interesting call actually with Chris Boardman and some people from British Cycling, and I've been lobbying for a couple of rule changes as well separately aside from that, actually on a sporting level, to be fair. So I guess that is big C cycling, but for kids, and nothing's happened yet, but I guess just need to be patient, and also with, you know, the plans that I'd like to have in East London and Hackney. It's just about, you know, doing things in the right way and not being in too much of a rush. So yeah, I don't know if anything's really happened yet, but it's something that I'd like to use whatever, you know, I don't know, platform is a horrible word, isn't it? But whatever that means, something along those lines to go with.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our longtime supporter. We are very grateful to them for that support. And if you would like some Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. If you also have a sports nutrition question for James Morton, either concerning your own nutrition for your own training or the pros, what they use and how they use it, email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll put those questions to James Morton of Science and Sport very soon. You can email us, either write out your question, or if you can, record it as an audio file and send it to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Well, that was Teo Gegenhart, the defending Giro d'Italia champion, and he will go to the tour this year. We were talking in the last part about the approach that Ineos will take to racing this year, and he said it's up to the riders ultimately and the personnel and the types of riders they have, and I think that's probably the truest statement.
Can I make a whimsical point in relation to gap year and Teo Gegenhart?
For new listeners, maybe you should explain the Lionel origins of that nickname.
Lionel traditionally does our explanation. He takes care of our explanation.
Okay, Lionel?
Well, I don't really know. Why do you know that?
Well, this relates to our first meeting with Teo years and years ago when he was a 17-year-old student, and he talked about setting off on his odyssey to conquer the cycling world in the way that a lot of kids of that age do, about, you know, talk about going to Bali on a kibbutz, or can you have a kibbutz in Bali? I'm not sure, but they're gap year before university. Anyway, and he took it in good heart, but it struck me, do you know, chaps, listening to him there, it struck me that students of English accents, particularly foreign listeners, might be confused as to how Teo Gegenhart and Bradley Wiggins come from the same city but have completely different accents. That's because something quite unusual and I suppose momentous has happened in London in the last 20 or 30 years from a linguistic point of view. The accent has completely changed, and the Durriga accent in London used to be Cockney, which even foreign listeners might have heard of. Now it's something called MLE. Do you know what MLE stands for, chaps? Multicultural London English.
Wow.
And Teo speaks with, I would say, an MLE accent.
To me, he speaks with a London accent, but maybe that's what it is. It's a modern London accent.
It's a modern London accent, which, yeah, it's sort of originated in Hackney, actually, exactly where he's from, in the East End of London, only about 20, 30 years ago, but Cockney has almost completely disappeared. There you go.
Wow.
It's funny thinking back to that first meeting with Teo, isn't it, in a pub by Liverpool Street Station, I remember. And he was, about to head off. He wasn't going down the path of British cycling and the academy. He was doing his own thing. He was off going to join Axel Merckx's development team, Axion, and live in Girona and follow what by then was quite a well-trodden path to try and become a professional cyclist initially. And it's been interesting following his progress, obviously, and all the way to winning the Giro, which still seems remarkable. I hope he's not offended by that, but it does seem remarkable when you think back to that kid in that pub in the east of London.
I also think it's remarkable because of the progress in his Grand Tour career. I mean, as a rider, he is the archetypal sort of Grand Tour stage race type rider, isn't he? He's not built for the classics. He's not going to do a sort of Paris-Roubaix, Tour of Flanders. So he's got that, that skill set.
Well, you say that, Lionel. He was third in Junior Paris-Roubaix quite a number of years ago.
Which year, Rich?
2013, I think.
The year Mads Pedersen won. So, but I think that the Junior Paris-Roubaix, I mean, that's an indicator of talent rather than an indicator of specialism, I would say. I mean, as a pro rider,
there have been
rider,
various examples, haven't there, in the past of riders. I think Jaroslav Popovic won it one year. Riders who have won that and then gone on to become very much Grand Tour rather than classics riders.
But as a pro rider, he's a stage race rider. And remember back a couple of years, the 2019 Giro d'Italia, where he crashed out. He cut a fairly forlorn figure even before that crash, because it wasn't going the way that he had hoped for it to go. And then later on that year at the Vuelta, he had a really horrendous start to that race. They were all at sea in the opening stages of that Vuelta, which had some tricky little climbs, and he lost a fair bit of time, but then had a really good final week. He was third on a stage and second on a stage and clawed himself up to 20th place overall. And then, of course, the Giro, where he went to be a support rider for Geraint Thomas, and just kind of almost sort of hibernated his way in. I don't mean sort of was doing nothing, because he was still participating in the race, still racing the race, but staying under the radar until really he was kind of ready to take things on. And then he made a couple of impressions, didn't he? And then really the final week was that ding dong with the Sunweb riders. And now, the next logical step is to go to the Tour de France. He's 25 years now. He'll be 26 by the time the Tour de France kicks off. So he's approaching that kind of first, sort of the peak years of his career. And as you said at the start, Daniel, I think you're absolutely right. Rather than going to the Giro or the Vuelta as an outright leader with a bit more expectation on his shoulders, probably the next step is to go into the Tour de France, which is the real, the furnace hot race. It is different to everything else. Whether you're leading the team or not, the intensity, the expectation on the team will be different. And he'll be able to experience what all of that is like without the pressure and expectation of being necessarily the number one rider in the team, and who knows, he may well flourish by just having a couple of sort of, so to speak, bodyguards in front of him, riders who are perhaps a bit more protected early on, and it's another kind of stepping stone towards going back to the Tour, perhaps at sort of 27, 28, 29 as the team's leader.
Chaps, do you look at the list of potential Ineos leaders for the Grand Tours next year or this year in 2021, and have what is your biggest concern about how they are going to cohabit, coexist, and the sort of battle—I don't want to say of egos, but it's a battle of or balancing the different objectives, imperatives. You know, in the Giro, there are potentially three riders who would be leaders in any other team. So it's Bernal, Sivakov, and Dani Martinez, I think, in the Tour, Thomas Carapaz and Teo. And one, we shouldn't forget Richie Porte either. And then Adam Yates has sort of been penciled
and Bernal, in. And Bernal possibly to the Tour as well.
Yeah, and Adam Yates has been penciled in for the Vuelta. You would think that, as always happens with the Vuelta, there will be someone who hasn't maybe had the best Giro or Tour will also be sent to the Vuelta. So there'll be lots of leaders there. You know, I just wonder how much that's also been a consideration in apportioning the riders to the different Grand Tours and who might get on with who. You know, that the sort of harmony factor. It's not going to be easy, is it? I mean, particularly you consider their contract situations. I think I'm right in saying that Geraint Thomas is the only one whose contract is up at the end of 2021. All of the others are committed to the team beyond that. And we shouldn't forget Rowan Dennis either.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to that point I was making, that there's currently no sort of obvious outstanding leader in that team. You would have said a year ago it was Bernal, you know, winner of the Tour de France, but there are just enough questions around him and his status now to look at it with a slightly more open mind. And I think there's nobody who has emerged, somebody might emerge, as the very obvious leader. So it's a fairly, it looks to me like, you know, it's a fairly kind of open field for all of those riders. I don't know. I mean, they strike me as, of all of them, and this is partly informed by the Movistar Netflix series last year, actually, of all of them, Carapaz might be the one who is most assertive in claiming that leadership role, because, you know, the way that he rode the Giro, the Giro that he won, was very impressive to watch from the outside, and then to see it from the inside as much as you could watching the Netflix series, that was impressive too. And I was struck by Brailsford's comments at the Tour last year that you know, he'd obviously really warmed to Carapaz, spending that time with him, and come to really admire his attitude. And if he goes to the Tour and manages not to lose that time in the opening days, the problem for him will be the time trials, of course. The Tour is the one that where there could be, you know, a bit of needle maybe. I mean, Geraint Thomas, the time trials will suit him. And a couple of weeks ago, we had Richard Pluger on the episode talking about, you know, had the stage 19 of the 2019 Tour not been stopped prematurely by the landslide, he thinks Geraint Thomas would have won the Tour and that he would have got away with Stephen Kruijswijk, and we would have been talking about something else entirely.
When you talk about harmony and getting everyone pulling in the right direction, the other question mark for me is still how Ineos have or will replace Nicolas Portal, who died tragically, of course, early last year. Because he's an impossible man to replace, and certainly someone who had experience. You know, if we think back to 2018, where Froome and Thomas had gone into that Tour, and both really hoping to win, Thomas did win. He's got experience of he had experience of managing those difficult situations. I know Rod Ellingworth is coming back to the team this year, but in terms of a director sportif who is very much the charismatic leader of the Tour group, I'm not sure that void has been filled yet. And beyond that, chaps, if we're talking individuals, the one that really intrigues me at Ineos this year is Pavel Sivakov, Siv. Ninth at the Giro in 2019 at age 21. Will be 24 in July. And do you know what strikes me most about Siv?
How can he be 21? Sorry. In 2019,
sorry,
and 24 this July.
We'll be 23. Sorry.
That's amazing.
The thing that strikes me most, impresses me, I suppose I could say, maybe worries me about Siv, is the amount he rides his bike. He practices cycling every day. No, in all seriousness, he rides an incredible amount. He's trained over 4,000 kilometers already this year. I did a bit of a deep dive into Strava to compare this with some other riders. And he's the rider I found who had ridden most this year. He trained 3,100 kilometers in December, 3,272 in January. So he's riding pretty much a grand tour every month. And the amount of climbing he's doing is quite extraordinary. He lives in Andorra. I said he'd done 3,272 kilometers in January, 59,662 meters of climbing. This does sort of, it is comparable to some other riders in Andorra. Robert Hastings, another one that trains an awful lot and climbs a huge amount. But if you compare that to other riders who live in sort of flatter parts of Europe, Rick Zabel was one I looked at. He's climbing and training on average, if you look at last year or so, about half as much as Siv. Siv last year, he climbed almost 600,000 kilometers. That's
wow,
all the way to the moon and halfway back. It made me start thinking about the scene in E.T., the famous scene in E.T. where Elliot is riding in front of the silhouette of the moon with E.T. in his basket. Yeah, in a whole different way, I thought that perhaps it wasn't him after all. It might have been Siv. In fact, it made me also think that we will keep tabs on this. And at the point this year where Siv actually rides the equivalent of the distance of the Earth to the moon, we will there'll be some kind of presentation to it.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's not going to be competing with Rick Zabel up the Stelvio, is he? It's maybe not the best comparison, but they don't. I mean, the comparisons are difficult because riders don't necessarily put all their rides on Strava.
There are some that do. I mean, unless they're training multiple times a day and putting one training session on Strava and one not.
Yeah,
It is quite interesting to contrast and compare the. Particularly, as I say, it varies a lot depending on where riders live. The riders in Andorra, I mean, this is something you hear them say anecdotally, they climb. If you've been to Andorra, there is no flat road. There's one valley road that goes through the middle, but otherwise it's all climbs. They do climb even quite significantly more than the riders in Monaco.
I mean, he's quite a big unit, isn't he, Sivakov? And those guys do maybe tend to do more kilometers or can take more kilometers. Maybe that's just an old wives' tale, I don't know. But he is clearly a huge talent. You know, he had such bad luck at the Tour de France last year with that two heavy crashes on day one at the Tour. He documented all that for the Cycling Podcast, of course, with his audio diary. But you know, he will definitely be a contender. That's a very strong team that Ineos are sending to the Giro. You know, we talk a lot about the Tour, but the three of them, Martinez, Bernal and Sivakov at the Giro, is really, really formidable. It'll be difficult to imagine another team being as strong as that.
But just on that volume of training, Rich, as well, in light of conversations we've been having over the last couple of weeks, particularly about Tom Dumoulin and, you know, things we mentioned today in relation to Thibaut Pinot, the way the game has changed. I look back some old interviews with Italian riders in the sort of late 90s talking about when they would start training again for the new season. So, you know, they were talking November and December, and you know, often they wouldn't ride their bike again and start building up for the new season until about the 15th of December. And, you know, I'm talking about Sivakov having climbed 60,000 meters in January, or climbed 45,000 meters, the equivalent of a grand tour, in December. It's quite extraordinary.
Daniel, you mentioned that Rod Ellingworth has gone back to Ineos Grenadiers, and he features in one of a few French specials that we've got coming up, doesn't he, Lionel?
Yeah, he does, Richard. I spoke to Rod before Christmas. Lots of people will be familiar with the name Rod Ellingworth, may well have heard him on the podcast before. He, of course, long association with British Cycling and Team Sky, and then went to Bahrain McLaren as, the number one in the hierarchy, really, running the team. And this year has gone back to Ineos Grenadiers. And just before Christmas, I wanted to talk to him about his kind of journey into cycling, really, and his early days. So it's a sort of introducing Rod Ellingworth. Who is Rod Ellingworth? For those who are not familiar with him, I think you get an understanding for him as a person as much as anything else from our conversation. So we'll put that out, I think, next week.
Yes, I listened to it on a mountain bike ride yesterday and thoroughly enjoyed it. He's a great storyteller as well. So there's a lot in there that I think people will find interesting. And I think you're going to do a part two at some point. He's busy now, obviously.
He is busy now. Yeah, it might be that part two isn't something we can do for a number of months. But I'd ideally like to do part two face-to-face over a sausage sandwich. That reference will be explained in the episode. But yeah, we haven't kind of covered his years in professional cycling. A lot more about his kind of where his philosophies and ideas come from, really. And like I say, I think that's something that's fundamental to any coach or manager in sport, isn't it? Who they are as a person shapes and influences the way they work with athletes. So. That's what I found interesting from it. So we'll put that out for friends of the podcast next week. We've got something coming before that, I think.
We're expecting the Vuelta route to be announced this week, and we're going to put out our Vuelta diaries from 2019 to coincide with that. So Lionel and I have spoken our diaries, and they'll be released this week. In a couple of weeks, we'll also have a special on Team Sunweb. Team DSM, and really kind of something we've done every year, who's been our team of the year. They were my team of the year last year, Sunweb. So I've done a lot of interviews with people in the team, Ivan Speckenbrink, who runs the team, and various people to find out what makes that team tick, what makes it different to other teams. The episode's going to be called A Team Apart, because it does seem that they are a little bit different to a lot of other teams. One of the ways in which they're a bit different to a lot of teams now is that they don't allow riders to use ketones. And you mentioned the Thibaut Pinot interview, Daniel, and Pinot also rails against the use of ketones. And Ivan Speckenbrink, very interesting on that subject and why he doesn't allow his riders to use ketones. So that and much more in that friend's special.
And if you become a best friend of the podcast, you will be sent in due course a cycling podcast, friend of the cycling podcast cap, and a tea towel beautifully designed by Simon Scarsbrook. If you are a good friend of the podcast, you will be offered the choice of one or other, cap or tea towel. I've been posting all of these out. If you're a friend of the podcast and you signed up in December or January, or your subscription renewed in December or January, you should have received an email. Lots and lots of parcels are out on their way. I've been a regular at the Royal Mail sorting office, dropping off. I've been enveloping up and sticking labels. It's been really quite rewarding, actually, Rich, posting all these things out to all corners of the world. As people have been emailing in just to give us their addresses or choose their cap or tea towel, so many people have sent us lovely messages as well. And just want to say thank you for those messages too, because it's been really nice to hear all your comments about what we put out over the past years. Thank you very much. They've been a real kind of morale boost as I've been at my kitchen table.
It's an amazing experience. I did the books last year. So whatever we produced as gifts for our friends, very good friends next year, Daniel will be charged with posting them out. So good luck. Good luck with that. but no, I found it a very enjoyable experience. Just see where people live, you know, not to actually check out their houses or anything, but just to get a sense of where people are. An awful lot of our listeners are in America, and it's amazing to recognize that. So thank you very much, everybody who listens and signs up as a friend of the podcast.
Should just say I am posting them out in batches. I'm going as quickly as I can. There's a lot to do.
It's a bit like the vaccination effort, isn't it, Lionel? It's a similar logistical challenge. You're Matt
it is,
Hancock.
Yeah, I would say.
Or no, who's the vaccine minister? I can't remember.
50 to 60% have been posted out so far. But I'm dealing with them in batches. So if you haven't had an email yet, don't worry, it will be on the way. And then by probably in March, I'll do a bit of a sweep. Anyone who hasn't responded yet, I'll send a reminder. But look out for the email that you'll get. Rather than contacting me direct would be great. So check your inbox.
Sorry, Daniel. Finally,
should we have round of Ineos predictions?
Go on then.
For 2021, just delight lineup. Ganna's going to win in Milan San Remo. I think Bernal will win the Giro. Actually, I do think he'll win the Giro. I think Dave Brailsford will dance samba on the Champs Elysees. But I'm not necessarily sure he'll be celebrating. I think Tom Pidcock will win the decathlon at the Tokyo Olympics. And Siv will make it to the moon.
You've taken all the best ones there, I think. How do you follow that? I agree. There are shades for me of Quintana at the 2014 Giro with Bernal going to the Giro this year. I think that's got the... That could be good for him. The tour is going to be more difficult, I think, for Ineos. I can't really go beyond that. I think any other concrete predictions? It's difficult. You've obviously thought about this and prepared them, and really kind of landed us in there.
2 minutes.
Ganna will not win Paris-Roubaix because he's not riding Paris-Roubaix, but he's possibly a future Paris-Roubaix winner as well, isn't he?
What about Adam Yates for Liège-Bastogne-Liège? Because we've barely mentioned him, and he doesn't. If he's not doing the Giro or the Tour, but does the Vuelta, maybe he will be a man for the spring.
I think he could have a cracking season. I think he's very underrated. Outside the Grand Tours, he's been unlucky in Grand Tours the last few years. Before lockdown, I had a look at this. He's on an incredible run of 13 top fives in his last 17 short stage races. He's probably the best rider in the world in 1 week stage races. And
there's so many riders that you almost forget about. Eddie Dunbar, you know, Ethan Hayter did a fantastic ride at Bessèges. You mentioned Laurens De Plus doesn't just want to be a domestique, but it's difficult. There are just too many riders to all have their opportunities, aren't there? And a guy like that could well end up doing a kind of Kwiatkowski-style role at the Tour de France. Kwiatkowski himself, I mean, there are just so many. Remember Gianni Moscon? He's still there. Contract year for Gianni Moscon. Let's hear what's rapidly becoming people's favourite part of the podcast. Thank you very much for all your submissions for our Slow Radio feature. Still waiting on Lionel's, but we've had a few. And the one we're going to play this week is a little bit different. Not really what's intended with this at all, but it was very funny. It made us laugh. It'll have to be bleeped, I'm afraid. But it's a bit of cyclocross from Ireland, supplied by Alan Ludlow.
Who left the pole in the middle of the shop? Ah!
Well, that was the cyclocross in Ireland pre-COVID, says Alan, and he sent us a video of it actually as well. Unfortunate set of circumstances. Hope the chap in question who hit the pole is okay. I think he was. He was just angry. Yeah, very good. Thanks very much, everybody who sent in some Slow Radio. We'll play a more conventional piece next week. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
Presumably that cyclocross event, when it's held again, will be setting out its course according to the new UCI regulations on safety and making sure that barriers and poles are not
absolutely
on the course.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully.
Well, that's all for this week, chaps. Although, Daniel, what's happened to your telling us something that we don't know feature that you launched so successfully last week?
Did you know that Filippo Ganna used to be a body double for another famous cyclist? He was Ryder Heyerdahl's body double for Castelli. Castelli clothing.
Wow.
There you go.
Many years ago.
Another great installment of that feature as well. We're on a roll. He's not exactly... He might have been the right build then. He's not exactly the right build now. He's a bit chunkier, yeah.
Bit chunkier. Bit more chunk in in the trunk.
Well, listen, that's all for this week. Thank... okay.
A bit more shake in the cake.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Daniel. Thanks, Lionel.
Thank you.
Thanks, chaps.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and me, Richard Moore. If you'd like to sign up to our newsletter to buy a Cycling Podcast book or cycling jersey, or if you'd like to become a friend of the podcast, please visit thecyclingpodcast.com. Thanks to Glass Pear and 13 Senses for the music, and thanks to Adam Bowie for producing this episode.